It's New Year's Eve. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And we're live today on the Line of Fire. What else could you ask for?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So how has your year been? As you look back at 2015, do you feel good about how this year has been in terms of your relationship with God, in terms of your ability to touch and help other people, in terms of how God has worked in you and through you? I hope so. If not, the good news is there's a new year coming and you can start afresh where you've fallen short. You can ask God for forgiveness. He's quick to cleanse us and wash us through the blood of Jesus and empower us to do His will. Michael Brown here, delighted to be with you. It is New Year's Eve. We're live. It's the last broadcast of the year, and it is a Thursday, which means Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Phone lines are open, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Maybe you're mainly at work at this time and unable to call, but today you're free. Any Jewish-related question you have, related to the Hebrew language, related to Jewish tradition or religion, related to Israel and the Middle East, related to specific Old Testament issues or issues having to do with Messianic prophecy or Jewish objections to Jesus, or even questions regarding Islam as a very close brother to the people of Israel through history, not always close in relationship, but by blood. If got any questions, I'll do my best to give you solid answers. If we don't have the answers, we'll look for them together. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. I also want to look back some at 2015, some reflections as well. God willing, on Monday, we'll talk about where I feel things are going in the new year. But a whole lot of things to talk about. Got some interesting audio clips to play for you as well. Spying. The question of America spying on Israel, that NSA targeted Israeli leaders and U.S. lawmakers. Let's hear what former governor and current presidential candidate Mike Huckabee had to say. Dennis, grab clip number 10. This is Mike Huckabee addressing the issue of spying, America spying on our ally, Israel. Number 10.
Even if they were able to penetrate the Prime Minister's office of Israel, the real issue is whether or not the President was aware that members of Congress were being tapped. If that's the case and the President was aware of it, Sandra, I believe that this is not only unconstitutional, I believe this is an impeachable offense, and Richard Nixon resigned for less than this.
Very serious charges here. This is Mike Huckabee on the Kelly file. He continues. Go to clip number 11. Let's hear what he had to say.
But the bigger issue comes down to whether or not the executive branch utterly abused its power, went way beyond its limitations, and spied on members of Congress. And that's why I'm saying that, I believe, is an impeachable offense. And the president should either resign or the Congress ought to have the guts to go after him. And you can't let the Justice Department do it. They're a toothless tiger. They will not do it. They've done nothing about the abuses of the IRS, nothing about Hillary Clinton's email problems. You can't trust them. There has to be a special investigation. But Congress is going to have to rise up and for once show a little bit of courage.
So this is going to be very interesting to see as it opens up. To what degree does everybody spy on everybody? To what degree is that just something that nations do, regardless of what arrangements they have? Either way, serious matters. We'll take your calls. We come back. Got more things to discuss with you as we come to the end of 2015, the beginning of 2016. I pray that your new year in the Lord would be wonderfully blessed and that you would bear much, much lasting fruit.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The stunning new report by the Wall Street Journal reveals that the NSA's targeting of Israeli leaders during the Obama administration's push to close a nuclear deal with Iran also swept up content from the conversations of some U.S. lawmakers.
Spying on Congress as well, our own government. If this is true, this is pretty wild. This is Michael Brown. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. It's also New Year's Eve. We're live, ready to take your calls. I'll be going to the phones momentarily, 866-348-7884. So CNN, the news report that the National Security Agency spied on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, is highlighting the Republican divide on civil liberties and national security. The Wall Street Journal reported Tuesday that the NSA maintained surveillance of Netanyahu and other U.S. allies despite a promise from President Barack Obama 2 years ago that he would end the practice. The paper, citing current and former U.S. officials, also said the communications between members of Congress and Netanyahu may have been collected in the surveillance. And House Intelligence Committee Chairman David Nunes, a California Republican, announced Wednesday his panel would seek more information from intelligence officials as it investigates the allegations. Senator Rand Paul went after this aggressively. He said this is exactly why we need more NSA reform, and the debate in Washington right now has been unfortunately going the other way. Dr. Carson slammed the president in a statement calling it truly disgraceful and blaming both Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He added, no doubt President Obama's former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton knew of the administration's spying efforts on Israel. It is shameful that she participated in undermining the U.S.-Israeli relationship. But Senator Marco Rubio, who has often clashed with Paul and other libertarian-minded Republicans on surveillance questions, urged caution before deciding the Obama administration was out of line. It will be very interesting to see how much attention this gets in the coming days. 866-34-TRUTH to the phones on the last Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast of the year. Valerie in the Bronx, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is the term Yeshua. My sister, she gets very upset when I say Jesus. She said I should be saying Yeshua, that I'm insulting God. So I wanted to know, is the interchanging Yeshua for Jesus and vice versa, is she correct in that matter?
No, she's very incorrect. She's very much incorrect, and as zealous and passionate as she may be, her zeal is misguided. The proper pronunciation of the Lord's name as he would have been known in Hebrew is Yeshua. Yeshua. Yes. All right? Now, it's important to know that to remind us that he's a Jew. His mother's name was not Mary, but Miriam. He was called Messiah. And then in Greek, the Greek equivalent of Messiah is Christ. So when a lot of people refer to him as Jesus Christ, he does not seem Jewish. He's disconnected from his Jewish roots. Many Jews think that Christ is his last name. Jesus was the son of Mr. and Mrs. Christ. So we want to explain that his real name is Yeshua, that he's called Christ because that's the Greek way of saying Messiah. But here's what's important to know, Valerie. Right from the start, when the New Testament was written, it was written in Greek. Why? Because it needed to get to the maximum number of people, Jews and Gentiles, and the common language that was most widely used was Greek. So right from the start, that change was made because in Greek, you don't have a sh sound, so the sh became suh, and instead of Yeshua, you had Jesus. So right from the start, it was a different name. And what was it saying? Relate to him in your own language. Relate to him in a name that is familiar to you. So just like my name, Michael, is Hebrew Michael. Well, when I'm in Israel, people can refer to me as Michael. Sometimes my Israeli friends will write to me as Michael. In English, I'm Michael, and everybody knows me as Michael. So it's the same way that what's most important is that you relate to him in your own language. So if you were Italian, you'd say Jesu. If you're Hispanic, Jesus. If you speak English, it's Jesus.
Okay.
If you speak Hebrew, it's Yeshua. So
you.
Your sister may be very zealous about this, but she's certainly wrong on it. And if you go to my website, ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and just type in Yeshua, Y-E-S-H-U-A, Yeshua. Then you'll be able to see some things I've written on that as well. All right?
Okay, thank you. Kind of quick question I wanted to ask you, Dr. Brown.
Go ahead.
Are the, right now, the Temple Mount, are the Jewish people, are they bringing the articles into the temple to rebuild it? Is that happening now as we speak?
As we speak, there is a group that has reconstructed the various articles. In other words, the priestly garments and the altar and the various items that would be used in the temple. They have made those. They have teaching and training and preparation, but there is no temple right now. What you have on the Temple Mount are two mosques, the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, and there's no way to build the temple with those mosques there. And if those mosques were to come down, it would be a massive war with the Muslim world, barring some type of bizarre intervention that would allow it to happen. So there's a lot of controversy over this, Valerie. There are religious Jews who do not believe we should be doing any of this, and we pray and wait for the Messiah to come. And when the Messiah comes, he will rebuild the temple, at which point all these other things can be done. There are others who say, well, we're preparing for the Messiah's coming. And then there are others who believe, no, one day we're going to rebuild the temple. Even before the Messiah comes, we're going to rebuild the temple, and we need to be ready. That last view is the most controversial. I would say it has the least support within Israel. Most religious Jews are not even thinking about that. They're just praying for the Messiah to come and rebuild the temple, etc. But there is a group. They can be visited right near the Temple Mount where they do their studying and where they've prepared many of the items for the temple. So it's a very fascinating time.
Wow, yes. Thank you so much. God bless you. Thank you.
You are very welcome. God bless you. All right, now, I just want to mention something on spelling, the name Yeshua. Jews for Jesus popularized this by having it as written as Y apostrophe S-H-U-A, so people would say Yeshua. The proper pronunciation would be Yeshua, but they had it that people would say Yeshua, the reason being that they thought people would mispronounce it even more if it was spelled correctly. So they colloquialized it a little bit, so you'll commonly see it spelled as Y apostrophe S-H-U-A. But in point of fact, that's not the best way to spell it. But Jews for Jesus did that quite intentionally. Yeah, clears that up for you, huh, Betsy? All right, 866-34-TRUTH, Washington, D.C. Andre, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Okay, my question was looking at getting away from the traditional Christmas celebrations and then observing some of the feasts of the Lord that God instituted to Israel.
Yes.
But I'm a Christian, so I was just, which feasts do you think are most relevant for Christians to continue to observe? You know, without necessarily observing all the law, but which feasts?
Yes. Yes, well, of course, if you were going to be observing all the law, then you'd be offering sacrifices and doing things like that. So obviously, we know that's not the case. And we know there's no obligation where you are required to do this, of course. But as far as the feast that has had the most participation by Christians over the years is the Feast of Tabernacles. Of course, it's an eight-day celebration, 7 days biblically and one additional day added on. But it symbolizes the ingathering of the nations. It symbolizes the harvest. So many times there are large Messianic Jewish celebrations where Christians join together. For example, a major ministry within Israel, the Christian embassy in Jerusalem, they have an annual tabernacle celebration that draws people literally from around the world. And they have a major procession down the street, and they have several days of special meetings. So if there's a Messianic congregation in your area, there are a few in the Maryland, D.C., Virginia area, you can just search, get online for Messianic Jewish congregations. They'll have a special tabernacle celebration. The other thing, if you can participate in something during Passover, if there is a Passover presentation done by a Jewish believer, that will point to elements of the death and resurrection of Jesus, even within the Passover traditions. So that can be a powerful thing to participate on. By the way, in my book, 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices, 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices, I touch on some of these issues too. God bless.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
If you're a Christian listening to this show, you know Isaiah 7:14 by heart. I mean, you know it in the Christian version. But you probably have never read Isaiah 15 and 16. And that's why you're not a dummy. You're smart. You're not reading the whole chapter. The sign is not the birth of the child. The sign is verse 15 and 16.
That was the voice of counter-missionary Rabbi Tovia Singer, who has declined to debate me, really refused numerous invitations to debate me or interact on any level for over 20 years. He's debated some Christian leaders and others, but right now, from what I know, he's not even debating Messianic Jews, period. It's an awful shame. Because it would be so enlightening for listeners, it would be so helpful for those that could view it and follow along and be able to examine things. It's a terrible shame when people will challenge one viewpoint, but then will not take an opportunity to interact. And listen, I wish I could interact with everyone that comments or sends questions, because we get tens of thousands of such things. I wish that I personally had the time to spend hours on the phone every day just letting people call and whatever they want to talk about, be able to talk about it and respond to every rabbi or anyone who's challenged me on a post. There's some websites with hundreds and thousands of comments just attacking my material. But I'm on record as saying, hey, by all means, any face-to-face debate with a qualified rabbi or counter-missionary, I say qualified to be fair, because what's the point of having an unfair debate? What's the point of me demolishing someone's position when they can't represent that position well? It's not fair to it. What's the point of a Muslim debating a Christian who's never read the Quran and doesn't even know what Islam is, and they're going to debate Islam? What's the point of that? What's the point of me debating a Muslim who doesn't even know what the Bible is in terms of reading it and content? You want to be fair, because you want it to be a fair debate. So any rabbi, any counter-missionary, any qualified person, of course, I'd debate them in a heartbeat. Debate them on radio, debate them with a neutral moderator, debate them in a live campus setting. That remains Rabbi Joseph Mizrahi, influential Orthodox Israeli rabbi now. I've reached out to him to debate. He wrote back to me and said, okay, answer all these questions first. Like, what is this, baby playing? Answer these questions first? Sir, I've been debating these issues for decades. I've written 5 volumes that answer all these questions and hundreds more in massive depth. Here, you want the answers? They're in the books. Never heard from. Someone else has been trying to set up a debate with Rabbi Mizrahi. Hasn't happened. I'd do it joyfully, in a heartbeat. It'd be very helpful. Same with Rabbi Singer. So, Tovia, if you hear this, the door is wide open. The reasons you've given for not debating are utterly vacuous. God knows that as well as I know that. So let's do it for the sake of the truth and for the sake of our Jewish people and for the sake of the glory of God. These clips were sent to me, and here Rabbi Singer was on Tanakh Talk, and he's being interviewed and talking about Isaiah 7:14, and Christians know the verse, you know, behold, the virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, call his name Emmanuel. They know it from Matthew chapter 1, verse 23. But they've never read Isaiah 7, verses 15 and 16. Actually, that's false. The majority of Christians have read the book of Isaiah. So they've read Isaiah 7, 14, 15, and 16. And if you want to be true to the sources, if you'll check traditional commentaries, there's great discussion as to what the sign is. And the foremost Jewish commentator even says that part of the sign was that she was a young woman and wasn't expected to give birth. Doesn't say she was a virgin, but just an alma, so a youthful maiden, wasn't expected to give birth. Others say the sign is the name of the child, Immanuel. That symbolizes God being with us. Others say the sign was imminent judgment coming. But anyone who knows anything about Messianic interpretation understands there may have been an application for Isaiah's day and then a further application. Just like Psalm 2, some rabbinic commentators say it is referring to David and the Messiah, not either or, but both and. Well, let's give Rabbi Singer, since he's not willing to debate, let's just give him a little opportunity to state his position here. We'll go to clip number 6. This was from a couple months ago, October 11th. Again, the clips were sent to me to interact with, so we're doing it on the air here. Again, Rabbi Tovia Singer attacking New Testament interpretation of the Hebrew Scriptures.
Matthew doesn't just change the word young woman into a virgin. He will strip this whole text and completely massage and rebuild it in order to fit his plot device for Jesus's infancy narrative. So therefore, if you go to Matthew 1:23, that's the critical passage, he doesn't have behold the young woman, is because you can't have the either. You can't have the definite article. It says behold a virgin. And it can't be is with the child, but shall be with the child. That has to be changed as well. And he can't have Mary, the mother, calling Jesus Emmanuel, because Mary is specifically told to call the child Jesus. You see that openly in the book of Luke. So therefore, if Mary never calls him Emmanuel, that the word, the Hebrew word, is vikaros. This is very simple, straightforward biblical Hebrew and modern Hebrew. Wouldn't make a difference. Any Israeli doesn't make a difference. Vikaros means and she will call. Matthew cannot have she will call, so he changes it. Look it up for yourself. And they will call. Who are they? They live in Brooklyn. Nobody knows who they are.
I have to laugh just because if you know the material, you kind of scratch your head and think, what in the world are you talking about? Matthew didn't manufacture a change from the Hebrew Alma to the Greek Parthenos. That's what the Jewish translators, the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, 200 years before the time of Matthew, they translated Alma to Parthenos, okay? Parthenos is primarily virgin, most likely meaning virgin. For some reason, they understood this to be virgin. So that's the first thing, all right? So Matthew didn't change that. Matthew didn't change the tenses either. That's just the way it is in Greek, okay? So Matthew was simply quoting the Greek. He was quoting that. It's just like if you're quoting the King James, you're quoting the NASB or the New King James or the ESV or the NIV, whatever you're quoting, that's what he was doing. He was quoting the primary Greek translation of the day because he was writing in Greek. And the Alma was, in fact, a Parthenos. The maiden, in fact, was a virgin. So it's accurate. And Matthew, as you study Matthew 1 through 4, was looking at Isaiah 7 through 11. He was looking at this in a larger context, understanding that these were promises to the house of David that were not yet fulfilled. There may have been something partial that happened in the days of Isaiah and King Ahaz, but there was not real absolute fulfillment. And Matthew is saying there must be more and looking for it, okay? And where it says, she will call his name. It's also possible the vowels could be you, which is masculine. But the generalization of they will call just simply means his name will be called. This is how he will be known. And in fact, around the world, he is known as Emmanuel, God with us. That's what the name means. And just like Solomon had a name, Yedidiah, that was not used for him. He was called Solomon. Same with Emmanuel. Hey, friends, have a blessed new year.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
That music tells you it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. It also happens to be New Year's Eve. This is Michael Brown, and this is the last broadcast of 2015, and I am taking your calls live today on any Jewish-related questions you have, anything related to the nation of Israel, anything related to the Hebrew Bible or language, anything related to Jewish tradition, anything related to, well, if it's Jewish-related, we'll talk about it. 866-34-TRUTH. There is a report I'm looking at. If you've never gone to memorytv.org, you ought to go there. You ought to go there. Oh, prepare to be disturbed, but you ought to go there. memritv.org. This is the Middle East Media Research Institute, Memory, M-E-M-R-I. Website, memorytv.org. They report on what's happening in the Middle East, what an Iranian leader, an Iranian imam preached in his mosque, what a Palestinian TV program aired, what an Egyptian cleric said. And they have the actual clips. You can watch the video with transcription. So they'll, if it's from Arabic or it's from Farsi, whatever the language, they will have it written on the English translation written out for you. And then, in many cases, you can actually click on a transcript. And you can actually get the transcript of the video and just read that if you need that. And I'm telling you, it's disturbing. It's shocking. It's eye-opening. So here's a report from December 28th. Michigan activist Lena Allen lambasts people who prohibit stabbing of Jews by Palestinians. Make sure you heard that accurately. Michigan activist Lena Allen, she's a Palestinian Jordanian activist living in Michigan. She has lambasted people who prohibit stabbing of Jews by Palestinians. In other words, if you have a religious leader who says it is forbidden for a Palestinian to just go up at random and stab an Israeli citizen, you shouldn't do it, or legal authorities trying to stop it from happening. She says it's like defending animal rights at best. She published a video in which she attempted to rebut the position of people who prohibit the stabbing of Jews by Palestinians. Allen called on these people to not talk about something they don't understand and to go back to watching Turkish soap operas instead. That's a quote. She added that objecting to the stabbing of Jews is like defending animal rights, quote, at best. In 2011, Allen co-founded the Jordanian Step and Mile NGO. And in 2012, she represented the State Department's U.S. Middle East Partnership Initiative in the Jameet Festival in Jordan, according to an interview she gave to the Jordanian Royal TV. In fact, I'm just taking a minute now and going over to the Memory TV site. Yeah, pretty wild. And this is an activist here living in the States. I'm just looking at, yeah, so here we've got Lena Allen. We've got that. You can watch that. Let's see. We've got Egyptian researcher Ahmed Abdu Meir, or Maher, ISIS implements Islamic heritage taught by Al-Azhar. You've got a Saudi cleric, Muhammad al-Munajjid. Treachery courses through the veins of the Jews like blood. Oh, I mean, it's one after another. Scary stuff to watch throughout the Muslim world. Check it out, Memory TV, M-E-M-R-I-TV.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, New Year's Eve. Michael Brown, blessed to be with you. Thanks for an amazing year in 2015. If you've been blessed by our broadcast, if you appreciate us being on the air, if you appreciate the work that we're doing among the lost sheep of the House of Israel in equipping the church and serving as your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution, then join with us, participate, stand together. Your year-end tax-deductible gift will be a great blessing to us. Help us end the year strong and move into the new year with momentum. So stand with us. Go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Click on Donate. And again, your year-end tax-deductible gift of any size will be greatly appreciated. 866-348-7884. We go to Richmond, Virginia. Jason, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
Hey, listen, I was just wondering, like, I see in the book of Genesis where, like, they first refer to Abram when he's still called Abraham as being a Hebrew but where do the terms Jew and Hebrew actually come from? Because it's not like they come, you know, I don't see, like, where they came from somebody named Heber or anything like that.
Yep. Yeah. The second one, the Jewish one, is very easy to answer. So I'll answer that one first. So you have the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 sons of Jacob, and one of them is Judah, right?
Okay.
So now you have, this is one of the 12 tribes. Then you end up having a division in the days of David's grandson, Rehoboam. So the son of Solomon, Rehoboam,
right.
The kingdom is split. So Jeroboam takes the 10 northern tribes. That becomes the northern kingdom, which is called Israel. And the southern kingdom is now called Judah. And that's under David and Solomon's descendant, Rehoboam. So Hezekiah, for example, was king of Judah. Manasseh was king of Judah. Josiah was king of Judah. That was the southern kingdom. Well, the northern kingdom gets decimated by Assyria in 721 BC. The northern tribes are exiled and scattered. Some make their way south to become part of the people of Judah. But basically what you have left now representing all the 12 tribes of Israel is the kingdom of Judah. And what happens is when they are then exiled into Babylon, 586 is the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem, 586 BC, Jews go into Babylon in exile. They come back, and now they're under the Persians, and it's called the province of Yahud from Yehuda, Judah. So it's now the province of Judah, and that of someone who lives there is a Yehudi, which is where we get Jew from. Yehudi in Hebrew is Jew in English. So now this is basically the place where the people of Israel live. Even though they're scattered in other parts of the world, this is their homeland. And it's called Judah or Yehud, and the people who live there are called Judeans or Jews. So you have, that's why you have lots of references to Jews in the book of Esther or Ezra or Nehemiah, because this is now after the exile, all right?
Right. Yeah.
So to this day, a Jew is referring to a member of the 12 tribes of Israel. All right.
Okay.
Now, the term Hebrew, you're right, it first occurs in Genesis 14, mentioning Abram, the Hebrew. Now, it's interesting that it next occurs with Joseph, and he's referenced there as a Hebrew. So he's an outsider to the Egyptians. And the same thing in Exodus, it mentions the Hebrews. And then you have, it comes up a couple times in Jeremiah, and then you have it in Jonah. These are a number of the key references just for Hebrew in the singular. When he says, I'm a Hebrew, again, he's an outsider. He's different. So where does it actually come from? There's scholarly debate about it. And ultimately, Hebrew and Jew are synonymous. And that's why you'll have some refer to themselves as Hebrew Christians. Jew is the term more universally used for the people. So in Germany, when they were singling out the Jews, it was Judah, you know, that was being singled out with the Jewish star. They didn't call them Hebrews as much as they called them Jews. But where did Hebrew come from? Well, there is the Hebrew root avar, which can mean to cross over, to pass over. Aver can mean over on the other side. So did it mean someone who passed over? Because it's Ivri. Ivri in Hebrew could be related to Aver, Avar. So someone who crossed over, maybe signifying a foreigner, possibly. Then there was a lot of speculation that you had these different groups of people in the ancient Middle East that were called Khabiru, and they were a certain class of people that were among the other peoples. Was it a term that was then borrowed, or that Abram was originally part of this identified people? That's just speculation. So okay. If someone says they know for sure where this came from, or it came from someone named Aver, and then Ivri is someone related to Aver, we simply don't know the origin. There's speculation. Okay. I've given you some of the major theories, but we don't know for sure.
Okay. And also with regards to, like, language origin, when you hear people refer to, like, you know, even Christian pastors who have, like, zero, who are totally on the side of Israel in the Israel-Palestine debate, will sometimes refer to, like, the region of Israel as first century Palestine, or why is that known as Palestine? Where does that come from?
Yeah, that we know very clearly when that happens. All right, so it's from the second century, a little bit over 100 years after the time of Jesus. It was instituted by the Roman Emperor Hadrian, and it was further retaliation against the Jewish people. There had previously been Judea, Samaria, you know, different regions like that.
Right.
And a lot of the life and ministry of Jesus, the vast bulk of it, unfolds in Judea, the province of Judea. But what happened was this. There was the first Jewish war against Rome from 66 to 70. It went on a few years afterwards, but 70 was when the temple was destroyed and Jerusalem fell. So you had the first Jewish war, terrible suffering of the Jewish people. According to Josephus, 1 million casualties. We don't know what the numbers actually were, but absolutely devastating as the Jewish people rebelled against Rome. And this is what Jesus saw coming and wept over. But still, it was still under Roman rule. There were Jews still living in Jerusalem and the province of Judea. And then there was the second Jewish revolt from 132 to 135 under the general Bar Kokhba, who some leaders actually thought was the Messiah. And they had some major victories, and they inflicted casualties on the Romans. They even began to mint coins, you know, from the first year of this new regime under Bar Kokhba, as if they were a free people. But instead, they were utterly, terribly crushed. And Hadrian then forcibly removed Jews from Jerusalem and erected a pagan temple instead of the temple, and renamed the region Palestine to mock them, because this was the name of the Philistines, who in the Bible had been an arch enemy of Jerusalem. And of course, they were known as uncircumcised because they came from another region. The people living in the Middle East, were many of them had practiced circumcision. That's why one reason God gave it as a covenant: you're coming into the land, you're going to do this because it's a covenant here, and it has significance here. But in any case, it was done by Hadrian in mockery of the Jewish people. And when people refer to Palestine in Jesus' day, it would not have been called Palestine. So you can refer to it as the land of Israel if you want, or you can refer to it as Judea, Samaria. But it was not called Palestine then. And when people still refer to it as Palestine, there's no basis for it.
Right. I've just heard the term first century Palestine, and I didn't know. And I'd also heard that, you know, Palestine came from the term from the same people as the Philistines. But
exactly. Yeah. And again, the Philistines were already long.
I didn't know the historical connection there.
Yeah. Yeah. The Philistines were already long gone as a people. They were basically extinct as a distinct people. And it was just something done, as I say, to mock the Jewish people and their relationship to the land. But to refer to first century Palestine would be as historically wrong. The term we use is anachronistic. It would be as anachronistic or as historically wrong as referring to 16th century United States of America. There was no such thing as the United States of America in the 16th century. There's no such thing as Palestine in the first century.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That was very helpful.
You are very welcome. Blessings on your new year. Look, when people give the outrageous comment that Jesus was a Palestinian. Not only is it completely absurd because Jesus was Jewish, not Arab, but there is no such thing as Palestine then. 866-34-TRUTH. Hey, I always have a blast answering your questions. Keep them coming. And we've got another hour. You may not get it on your radio station, but we've got another hour. You can catch that by going to AskDrBrown.org. Click on Listen Live. Or later today, it will be archived online free thanks to our great team and their hard work and the generosity of so many of our supporters that we can put these online free for you. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
This is Michael Brown. You hear that sound? It's telling you it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, and it is the last day of 2015. It's the last day to ask me a question on the air in 2015. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. We go to Houston, Texas. Nathan, welcome to Line of Fire.
Oh, Dr. Brown. My question is regarding something specifically in Genesis chapter 10. Mm-hmm. The reason why I was studying this chapter closely is because I've been reading on my own time a book about Mesopotamian history, and this is another one of the reasons I was, you know, taking another look at Genesis 10, talking about reorganization and restart of civilization. So, but I was curious about the meaning of the name Nimrod. What specifically? Now, I've been studying Hebrew for a while, but you know, I mean, some of these names, you know, the way they combine words, I'm not sure. I'm not always able to pinpoint what they mean exactly. But I wanted to get your take on that. And also, if I could ask, related to the subject, I personally, I'm a philosophy student, but I've been feeling a strong call by God to go into Semitic studies, or at least that's what I feel in my heart. Mm-hmm. And since you're an expert in this field, what advice or recommendation would you give?
Yeah, so, okay, great. Thank you. And how old are you, Nathan?
I'm 25. So
25,
okay. I'm about to graduate with a philosophy degree. And I love philosophy, but I also love Hebrew. I love Aramaic, Ugaritic.
Got it.
I've studied those languages, but I want to expand my field as well.
Got it. Yeah, well, wonderful. And it is interesting because studying languages is not abstract. It's line upon line. Studying philosophy is very much abstract. And many times people who are really good in ancient language study are also good in mathematics or something like that, whereas, you know, philosophers I wouldn't think of necessarily being good in math. You know, so it's interesting to have the interest in both, which I think is terrific. So let me give you the advice first. There are programs, there are plenty of schools, major universities will have some type of program with Hebrew and things like that, but plenty of schools, either Jewish schools or Christian seminaries, that do have advanced programs in Semitic languages, and most of them have excellent scholars who are teaching there. The one thing is, when you're learning languages, the professor is going to help you a lot, but the great bulk of it is going to be the study that you do on your own, the work that you do on your own. And a good rule for learning languages is a little, a lot. If you have the opportunity to put in hours and hours a day reading the language, reading the text, that's wonderful. But it's better if you only had an hour a week to let that hour be 10 minutes a day, 6 days a week, as opposed to just 1 hour once a week, because you tend to remember more with the constant repetition and keeping it in front of you. Also, do whatever you can do to work with the text itself without a translation, and to struggle and to battle and to use the dictionaries and to try to figure it out and then to go to the translation, because you'll learn the language much better. Looking at the translation can short-circuit it. Now, it all depends on how much you know as far as doing that. If it's very fundamental in terms of your knowledge, then that's going to be harder to do. But that's also a good, healthy recommendation. It's much more challenging. It can be discouraging, but it's the best way to do it. Now, I've not always done that myself, but I'm just saying it. When you really want to learn it, that's the way you've got to do it. And sometimes
I absolutely do, because, you know, also another reason, and forgive me for interrupting, but, you know, I mean, I am a Jewish believer, mm-hmm. and this is another reason why I did not grow up with Hebrew.
Yeah, same here.
This is why I love Hebrew, and this is why I also want to use it to God's glory. So.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. I mean, I grew up with very little Hebrew, so I remember the first day of taking Hebrew in college, I was ahead of a number of people in the class. The second day, they knew as much as I did. I mean, whatever I had remembered was that little. But the other recommendation is to do your best to really learn the languages, the few key languages. Do your best to learn those and then build. What happened with me is I did that, but I also studied so many languages at the same time, as many as six at the same time, that I didn't learn some of them as well as I could have. So by all means, yeah, so you're studying Hebrew, Aramaic, Ugaritic. Then let's say you add Akkadian, let's say you add Arabic, and then the other branch of Aramaic, Syriac, which is important, and you looked at those. The problem is that, say, Akkadian and Arabic are tremendously challenging in themselves and take years and years to really learn well. So what you want to do is keep building the foundations, Hebrew first, then Aramaic, and then you add and acquire from there. As far as names, remember names can often be plays on words. For example, from Avram to go to Avraham because of a Hamon, a multitude of peoples that if you just saw Avraham, you wouldn't associate that with Hamon unless that was said to you. Or Bavel being the place where God Baal, where he confused the languages. That's a play on words in Hebrew because it goes back to Babylonian or Akkadian, Bab Elu, gate of the gods. So there can often be plays on words. Nimrod, the only root that we see in that is the root Mem Resh Dalet, M-R-D, which means to rebel. Hence, Nimrod has the reputation in ancient literature, in rabbinic literature, has the reputation for being a rebel. And in fact, in rabbinic literature, his name is interpreted as he who made all the peoples rebellious against God. Now, it could be that it came from an Akkadian root with a different meaning, but in Hebrew, what you'd associate with it, the nun at the beginning would potentially be a nifal form and something passive about it, someone in a state of rebellion, but you'd immediately associate it with the root marad, hence rebel of some kind. So whether he was named by that, whether that became a name he was given, whether the name meant something else originally, but we now know it as rebellious. He's been known as the rebellious one based on that. Mm-hmm. Hey, Nathan, I am out of time, but you have a blessed new year. Keep up your studies and check in with us from time to time.
All right. Thank you.
You're very welcome. All right, friends, I'm going to keep taking calls one more hour. So get in now. 866-34-TRUTH. If you're on hold now, stay with me. I'll take your calls on the other side of the hour. Remember, we still are offering all of my top apologetics resources. We extended it by one more week at 30% off. So you can still order all of my top apologetic resources, any one or all of them, at 30% off. To find out what they are, go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. You'll see it right on the home page. My bottom line today, as we explore the scriptures, the history of Israel, let's build our foundations right so what we build on them will be built to last. It's New Year's Eve. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And we're live today on the Line of Fire. What else could you ask for?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, here we are, the last day of 2015. What a year it's been. I'm excited about moving into 2016, full of faith, expectation. And it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. Had a delightful time answering a bunch of interesting questions from you, our dear listeners. 866-348-7884. I've got some Jewish-related news for you as well. Be taking more questions this hour. Maybe this is a rare opportunity for you to call. Maybe this is a rare opportunity for you to call because you're not working today, your schedule's changed, maybe you're off work early. Well, here we are, ready to take your calls, answer your questions. It'd be Hebrew-related, Jewish tradition-related, Judaism-related, Middle Eastern-related, Old Testament-related, Messianic prophecy-related, Jewish objections to Jesus-related, even Islam-related. Glad to take your calls, 866-348-7884. Before we get into some interesting Jewish news, let's go right to the phones. We'll start in Auburn, Maine. Mike, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hi. You hear me?
Yes, I do.
Okay. My question is, if we're all descended from Adam, aren't we all essentially Jewish?
No. The concept of Jewish comes in many, many centuries later. There was no such thing as Jewish or Gentile in the days of Adam and Eve. There was no sense of a chosen people and chosen nation until the time of Abraham, which is at least a couple thousand years later. And then even then, you had the children of Israel and the nations of the world. So the Goyim would then be the nations of the world and the Gentiles and the children of Israel. And then it was only centuries after that before there became the name Jew or Jewish to be used for all the tribes of Israel. So we're all descendants of Adam and Eve. We're all from the same human race. But no, to say Jewish, that would be descending from a specific group of people that did not arise until many centuries later.
Okay, so it's more a religion rather than birthright.
No, it's an ethnicity as well. I mean, it's absolutely an ethnicity. But this people that we call Jewish did not arise until many, many centuries later. And then you can trace that people ethnically over the centuries. So why would we say Adam and Eve were Jewish when there was no such thing at that time?
Thank you.
Yep. All right. Thanks for the question. I appreciate it. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll go to Bill in Phoenix, Arizona. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for the opportunity. This is one of the few times I have opportunity, too, to call. The Kedoshim were sleepers. In Matthew 27:52-53, they were seen coming out of the tombs, which would be the most recorded of all historical events, what we'd call modern within the last 2,000 years, if it really happened on this earth. Therefore, since Matthew was inspired by the Holy Ghost to write this, wouldn't you say this is proof of a literal Jerusalem above?
No, I wouldn't see it like that at all. The Kedoshim, that just means saints or holy ones. It has nothing to do with sleepers. It's saints or holy ones. And it's quite an extraordinary account. Many are skeptical of it because it speaks of a resurrection of many. But we have to take that as a first fruits of what was to come. Of a first fruits, we don't know what happened to those people. It's only recorded in Matthew. At a certain point, obviously, they died. Did they just go back to the graves? Were they taken up by God? We don't know. It's a very unusual statement. Some look at it as figuratively, of speaking of resurrection, but it seems to be something literal that Matthew recorded. They were sleeping in the ground. They were raised up temporarily, and it is a sign of the first fruits. It's a foretelling of the final resurrection and could have other meaning as well. Hey, thank you for the call.
Fire we want, for fire we please. Send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
As always, my foot is tapping when I hear that clip. Michael Brown, welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, our last broadcast of 2015. 866-34-TRUTH, Recovery Way Live, 866-348-7884. Our studio, our office building is pretty empty, but as long as I'm here and we've got our team doing our broadcast, we are ready and good to go. So any Jewish-related question of any kind, 866-34-TRUTH. I am looking at an article by Daniel Larson, posted yesterday on the AmericanConservative.com, or Daniel Larson, excuse me, the most awful and absurd foreign policy quotes from 2015. Now, some of these do tie in with the Middle East. John Kerry on Yemen, and this was November 23rd of this year, his remarks with the foreign minister of the United Arab Emirates. We respect what the United Arab Emirates has been able to do to be able to accomplish significant progress in Yemen. We understand completely and support the reasons that Saudi Arabia and the UAE felt compelled to take acts of self-defense and to protect the security of this region. And I know that the UAE has made sacrifices in that effort. We understand those sacrifices in the United States, and we respect what has been achieved. We respect the values that the UAE is standing up for. Whoa, that's wild. As Daniel Larson says here, Kerry offers up a complete whitewash of the Saudi-led coalition's wrongdoing in their war on Yemen and endorses their specious justification for intervention. The quote from Kerry briefly sums up most of what's wrong with Obama's administration's support for the appalling and indefensible Saudi-led war. I mean, you're talking about real suffering and tragic upheaval in Yemen. We don't hear about it that much. Let's just say that I am close to people, contacts that I have that have worked in Yemen for some years, and they've been through thick and thin there, and they had to leave because of the depth of the civil war and the upheaval there. And the Saudis played a role in that. Again, on the list is number two, Marco Rubio, January 20th of this year on the O'Reilly Show. A Shia actually wants there to be an apocalyptic showdown because they believe that that will then usher in the appearance of the hidden, the 13th Imam. I mean, you listen to their speeches, they're very clear about that. Well, in response, Daniel Larson says there is no 13th Imam. Shia clerics and Iranian officials don't say anything like this in their speeches. Rubio was repeating a thoroughly discredited lie about Iran as the martyr state. Is it thoroughly discredited? Is it thoroughly discredited? Is there not a Shia eschatology? If you are a Shiite Muslim or a former Shiite Muslim and would like to comment on this, or you have studied this out in a serious way, not just on some conspiracy theory internet blogs, is it thoroughly discredited? The idea of an apocalyptic showdown or a hidden imam, is that thoroughly discredited? I wonder where the information is that that was thoroughly discredited. That would not be on my list. Let's see, Lindsey Graham, that's about Putin. Chris Christie, that's about Putin as well. All right, Hillary Clinton, October 13th, Democratic debate. So this is about Libya, so we'll talk about that. It's a Muslim country. Our response in Libya, which I think was smart power at its best, is that the United States will not lead this. We will provide essentially unique capabilities that we have, but the Europeans and the Arabs had to be the first over the line. In response, Larson says the fact that Clinton thinks smart power at its best involves being dragged into an unnecessary war by allies and clients in a civil war in which the U.S. had nothing at stake tells you everything you need to know about her foreign policy judgment and the value of her version of smart power. John Kasich on a Syrian no-fly zone, December 15th, Fifth Republican main debate. He said, it's time we punched the Russians in the nose. Larson says Kasich has been trying his hardest to be one of the most combative and hawkish candidates in the Republican field, and his performance that night was no exception. The reckless desire to punch another major power in the nose, regardless of the consequences, sums up his approach of confrontation for its own sake. Anyway, those were some of the quotes that were listed as the worst of all. Again, just some year-end data that and items that we're discussing and looking at. Tim Chester posted this on the Gospel Coalition, 10 questions to ask of New Year's resolutions. Jonathan Edwards, as a young man, wrote out his famous list of 70 resolutions, and he sought to live by these all the days of his life, and they are very, very challenging, to say the least. And this is not what the article is about. The article is questions to ask ourselves. But since we're at it, since many of you are making resolutions, here are some of Jonathan Edwards' year-end resolutions. Though this is not thoroughly Jewish, but it's good reading on New Year's Eve as we intermix. Is that a word? Intermix? I think so. Matt, is that a word? Intermix? As we mix together Jewish issues, Jewish calls, and New Year's Eve type stuff, end of the year type stuff. Resolution number one, resolved that I will do whatsoever I think. And okay, so being sensible, I'm unable to do anything without God's help. I do humbly entreat him by his grace to enable me to keep these resolutions so far as they are agreeable to his will for Christ's sake. Remember to read over these resolutions once a week. He's a young man when he makes these, what, just in his 20s. Resolved that I will do whatsoever I think to be most to God's glory and my own good, profit, and pleasure in the whole of my duration, without any consideration of the time, whether now or never so many myriads of ages hence. Resolved to do whatever I think to be my duty and most for the good and advantage of mankind in general. Resolved to do this, whatever difficulties I meet with, how many and how great soever. That's number one. Number two. Resolve to be continually endeavoring to find out some new invention and contrivance to promote the aforementioned things. Number three, resolved, if ever I shall fall and grow dull so as to neglect to keep any part of these resolutions, to repent of all I can remember when I come to myself again. Number four, resolved, never to do any manner of thing, whether in soul or body, less or more, but what tends to the glory of God, nor be nor suffer it if I can avoid it. Number five, resolved, never to lose one moment of time, but improve it the most profitable way I possibly can. Number six, resolved to live with all my might while I do live. Number seven, resolved never to do anything which I should be afraid to do if it were the last hour of my life. Oh, chew on that one for a while. I think I'm going to tweet that out and post that. Resolution number seven of 70 of Jonathan Edwards. Resolved never to do anything which I should be afraid to do if it were the last hour of my life. Number eight, resolve to act in all respects, both speaking and doing, as if nobody had been so vile as I, and as if I had committed the same sins or had the same infirmities or failings as others, and that I will let the knowledge of their failings promote nothing but shame in myself and prove only an occasion of my confessing my own sins and misery to God. Wow. So when somebody else sins, when somebody else does wrong, that he is now ashamed of his own sins and repents for his sins rather than mocking and attacking them. Number nine, resolve to think much on all occasions of my own dying and of the common circumstances which attend death. Number 10, resolved when I feel pain to think of the pains of martyrdom and hell. Now here's the problem. Here's the problem. When you're in a lot of pain, that pain is all-consuming. At the end of my workout today, because of the heavy leg workout we did and some of the things we did, he said, oh, I need to stretch your legs here, your hamstrings and some things, and it was painful. I was screaming out in pain as he was stretching me. And he's laughing. That's what trainers do. Problem is when you're in pain, it's hard to think about others because the pain is consuming, but sometimes that does help you. Jonathan Edwards was not doing this to be therapeutic, but to think, okay, if I'm in pain, someone's in much worse pain. Someone's suffering much worse pain in martyrdom. someone suffering much worse pain for the gospel, and someone suffering much worse pain because they've rejected the Lord and are suffering the pangs of hell. So he was determined to use that pain redemptively. I have time for a couple more. Resolved, this is number 11, when I think of any theorem in divinity to be solved, immediately to do what I can towards solving it if circumstances don't hinder. He was obviously a theologian and a philosopher. Resolved, if I take delight in it as a gratification of pride or vanity or any such account, immediately to throw it by. So if I get some insight, revelation, work out some theological difficulty, to immediately make sure that I am not proud of it. If I am, then I throw it away. Repent. We'll be right back. 866-34-TRUTH.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Thanks, Paul Wilbur, for singing about our faith in God and His Messiah. It's the last broadcast of 2015. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So taking your calls on any Jewish-related subjects, Hebrew-related subjects, anything in my areas of expertise or knowledge in any of these Middle Eastern affairs, be it contemporary or be it historic. Another reminder, if you're listening to me in the greater Charlotte area, so if you're in Winston-Salem, if you're in Raleigh, if you're in Charlotte, if you're in Fort Mill, if you're in Greenville, South Carolina, anywhere in this area, you are invited, as one of our beloved listeners, to our first ever Night to Ignite Vision Banquet. It's January 28th. We've got a great meal for you, a free meal. David and Jason Benn and the Benham Brothers in demand all around America, they'll be speaking. I'll be bringing a short word of inspiration as well. It's going to be a faith-building, enjoyable night. And we want to give you an opportunity to partner with us and stand together with us to help amplify my voice, which is your voice, of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Help amplify my voice in 2016. So it's going to be a great, fun night, an edifying night, and a night where I can meet you face to face. We still have seats available, but this is an intimate event. This is not an event with multiplied hundreds and hundreds of people by design. So this is an intimate event, and we still do have seats available, but we need to hear from you if you are coming. So go to nighttoignite.com, and you'll see RSVP. Just let us know that you're coming. You can come with your spouse. We would love to meet you. 866-34-TRUTH. So this idea that a journalist mentioned mocking Marco Rubio, Senator Rubio, for referring to a hidden imam or a 13th imam, and there is no such thing. I'm wondering why Daniel Larrison was saying this has been thoroughly debunked. So Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, reported this January 22nd of 2015, so almost a year ago. Iran's former hardline president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has reportedly said that the United States is working to arrest the hidden imam who, according to Shiite belief, went into hiding in the 10th century and will reappear to bring justice to the earth. I mean, there is this belief. Why was Rubio castigated for saying it? Ahmadinejad made the comments in a speech to a group of clerics, marking the start of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan, according to a transcript posted on June 21st, so it would have been 2014, of a particular website. Ahmadinejad is quoted as saying that the West has been building a case against the hidden imam to prevent his reappearance, a claim that the Islamic Republic's main reformist daily newspaper, Sharq, described as strange. They've done so much research about the hidden imam in the human science universities in the United States that I'm not exaggerating by saying that it is 1,000 times more than all the work done in the seminaries of Qom, Najaf, and Mashhad. Ahmadinejad, who's known for his controversial statements and his devotion to the hidden imam, added that the U.S. universities have debriefed numerous individuals who have been in touch with the disappeared spiritual leader. Now remember that this goes back to a tradition which is many centuries old, all right? So one of these traditions, the legend grows. Ahmadinejad is quoted as saying, "It is really a government established by Satan to prevent reaching God and the hidden imam. This evil government, speaking of the U.S., knows that its end will come if the hidden imam reappears." He reportedly acknowledged that some in Iran laugh about these comments. But yeah, this is something that is believed and taught. It doesn't mean that all Shiite Muslims hold to that theology, but it is something. This Islamic Redeemer, the Mahdi, expectation of the Mahdi was running so high that people were leaving food out for him before they went to sleep. Some circles, there is this real, real deep expectation. So to ridicule Senator Rubio for referring to it, I don't know where that is coming from. All right, real quick, Tim Chester on Gospel Coalition posts 10 questions to ask of New Year's resolutions. 1, how would you like to change? 2, why would you like to change? 3, how are you going to change? 4, when do you struggle? And this is all expanded. It's got practical teaching. 5, what truths do you need to turn to? 6, what desires do you need to turn from? 7, what stops you from changing? 8, what strategies do you need to put in place to reinforce faith and repentance? 9, how can we support one another in change? 10, are you ready for a lifetime of daily change with good practical wisdom along the way? Let me throw this out to you. There must be a serious determination if you're going to see serious change. More of the same will only produce more of the same. Nothing magical is going to happen between today and tomorrow. It's the new year. I just turned 20. I just turned 30. I just turned 70. Nothing magical happens with the passing of a day. Even in something as serious as marriage or having a child, you're still the same person. You're still the same human being. And if you're going to make changes, you're going to have to make those changes in a serious way with the help of God. Look, for many years, I would be overweight, still working out, still with an active life, but overweight, needing to lose a good amount of weight. And somehow I thought that tomorrow was going to be different, that tomorrow was going to be better, that my plan that didn't work up to now was going to work tomorrow. That's complete self-deception. It's Albert Einstein who said that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And that's the way I lived for years and think, okay, it's going to be different. Unless you make it different, it's not going to be different. Unless you make a determination before God and with his grace and help to live differently, you will not see changes come. Now, sometimes God intervenes in our lives. People are praying for us and something happens. But unless we cooperate with that intervention, we're still going to hit a brick wall. So, got to recognize it. My plan is not working. In fact, I'll talk more about that on the other side of the break. But you got to say, okay, what I've been doing thus far won't change things. More of the same will only produce more of the same. It's going to take a radical change if I want to see lasting change in my life, and God will help you to do it. All right, friends, a lot more to talk about in our end of the year broadcast. If we've been a blessing to you, would you stand with us? Would you show your support by going to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Click on donate and help us with a year-end gift of any size. From my heart, thank you for standing with us.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know when revolutions take place? Revolutions take place when people get to the breaking point, when people say enough is enough, when people say more of the same is only going to produce more of the same, and we need radical change. This is Michael Brown. I'm delighted to be with you on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, which is also New Year's Eve, the last day of 2015. I am coming your way live. I am taking your calls, 866-348-7884. That's 866-34-TRUTH. And we'll do Thoroughly Jewish Thursday questions, as we did the first hour. Any Jewish-related question, Hebrew-related question, especially Old Testament-related question, modern Israel-related question, Middle Eastern-related question, even Islamic-related question, Judaism questions, any like that, we'll do our best to give you solid answers. 866-34-TRUTH, your last time to call the line of fire in 2015. So I just posted this on Twitter. If your plans have not been working up until today, don't think they're going to start working magically tomorrow. Don't deceive yourselves. More of the same, friends, will only produce more of the same. So let me address this issue with a little story from my own life, all right? Some years back, when we lived in Pensacola, Florida, Nancy noticed, my bride of almost 40 years now, Nancy noticed that I'd put on a little weight. And she said to me, "Hon, I think you put some weight on." Now, why would she bring it up? Number one, health, just healthier, not to be overweight. And number two, just my general witness. I said, "You know, hon, actually, you're right. I have put a little weight on. I have. But I have a plan." She goes, "Oh, okay, good." Maybe 6 months later, she said, "You know, hon, you haven't lost any weight at all." I said, "You're absolutely right. I haven't." I said, "But I have a plan." She said, "Oh, okay." So it's maybe 6 months, a year later. And she says, "Hon, I think you've gained more weight." And I said, "Yeah, I have, but I have a plan." And she said to me, "Your plan is not working. Your plan is not working." I've told pastors, leaders around the country that sometimes that should be what we put on the marquees in front of our building. Your plan is not working, meaning our plan, because more of the same is only going to produce more of the same. And somehow, because I'm a very positive person, an optimist, that's the way I'm wired, that's the way I am in God, that's who I am after decades of experience walking with the Lord, that it's easy for me to have this attitude, today is good, tomorrow's going to be better, for no good reason. In other words, tomorrow in itself is going to be no different than today unless I do something differently to make it different. If I was lazy and slept in today, tomorrow's not going to be any better unless I make choices, either go to sleep at an earlier time or just to get up when I hear the alarm. If I overate today, tomorrow's not going to be any better. If I ate in an unhealthy way today, tomorrow's not going to be any better just because, it's New Year's or it's my birthday. It's not going to be any better in itself unless I do something differently. So it was August of 2014 that I said to Nancy, "My plan is not working." I mean, using the language from many years ago, and she knew exactly what that meant. Because I've always got these other plans. I'll get in better shape doing this. I'll lose weight doing this. And I realized this just hasn't worked. And over the years, as my metabolism slowed down and so on, just on the road so much, eating things that aren't the healthiest, and some are downright unhealthy, in point of fact, I was getting heavier. I'm getting older, and my blood pressure was getting high, starting to get high. And I thought, okay, my plan's not working. And Nancy helped me to make a radical lifestyle change. I lost 95 pounds in 7.5 months. I've kept it off now these months since. I weigh 180 pounds. My cholesterol is 123. My blood pressure is maybe 100 over 65. It was as high as 149 over 103. What happened is God helped me make radical changes. Radical changes are the only things that are going to produce long-term radical change. If your plan hasn't been working, acknowledge it. We'll be right back with your calls.
Send it, Lord. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You may have heard this song. It's Hava Nagila, and it's Hebrew. Come, let us rejoice. Let us be glad in Him. Great words. By the way, last half hour, I talked a little bit about the Shiite belief in a hidden imam, and some say that's been completely debunked. There is no such thing, the 13th imam, the hidden imam, this apocalyptic figure, redeemer. And others, of course, it's well known. And I read a quote, I didn't identify it to you, but The Economist reports this September 29, 2013. It's been noted by Mehdi Khalaji, an Iranian-born and theologically trained analyst who now works for a think tank in Washington, D.C., that the wild metaphysical talk of Mr. Ahmadinejad, so we quoted Ahmadinejad, the former leader of Iran, of course, under Ayatollah Khamenei, who's the supreme leader of the country, but the elected leader, and he spoke much about these apocalyptic views and the hidden imam and all of this. And according to Khalaji, this put him at odds with Iran's mainstream clerics. Apocalypticism, so this end-time final conflict, has little influence in the main Shia seminaries, and it has been a marginal phenomenon in the clerical world. As Mr. Khalaji has written, after all, the return of the hidden imam means the end of the clerical establishment, because the clerics consider themselves the representatives of the imam in his absence. Hence, they do not propagate the idea that the hidden imam will come soon, because when he comes, they're out of business. Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, was one of the clerics who complained that the apocalyptic talk fostered by Mr. Ahmadinejad was having unhealthy effects. Around the time of that 2008 speech by Ahmadinejad, Mr. Rouhani, who was educated both at Iran's Qom Seminary and a university in Scotland, lamented that superstitious expectation of the Mahdi, this hidden imam, the Redeemer, was running so high that people were leaving food out for him before they went to sleep in case he should appear that very night. Is that wild or what? 866-34-TRUTH. We go to the phones. I was going to David in Dallas, but I guess he couldn't hold. David's question about coordinating the God of the Old Testament with the God of the New Testament, even if David's not still here, it's a worthy question to ask. It's important to remember that the God of the Old Testament is the Father of Jesus, and Jesus loved his Father. It's important to remember that the Bible, the first Bible of the early church, was what we call the Old Testament. Those were the Hebrew Scriptures. That was the Bible. And that was the God they served and worshiped, a God who brings judgment and a God who shows mercy. Think of Psalms like Psalm 103. As a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who love him. As far as the east is from the west, so far as he removed our iniquities from us, he remembers our frame. He knows that we're just dust. The end of Micah 7, who's a God like you? How is he described? Forgiving sin, overlooking the transgression of his people. He loves to show mercy. He doesn't hold on to his anger forever. The Psalm 23 and the Lord being our shepherd, these are all wonderful, wonderful verses describing God in the Old Testament. And he is a God of justice as well. And a God of vengeance. What does Paul say in Romans 12? Don't take vengeance on yourself, but do what? Leave vengeance to God. When Jesus returns in the New Testament, how does he return? According to the New Testament, when he returns, he's coming in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who don't know God. Think of this. The book of Revelation speaks of God's final judgments being poured out on the earth, and they are dreadful. Hebrews 12 and Hebrews 10 and Hebrews 2 all tell us that if there was judgment under the Sinai covenant, how much greater judgment will there be under the new covenant, because so much has been given to us. So much has been given to us, so much privilege, so much relationship, so much forgiveness, open access to God, that more will be required of us. Of course, the emphasis in the New Testament is on mercy through the cross, but judgment is an ever-present theme in the New Testament as well. It is coming. Paul talks about the coming wrath of God on unbelievers. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, so I wanted to mention that to you. Let me give you an end-of-the-year principle. As we're thinking about moving into a new year, let me give you an end-of-the-year principle. Jesus gets into this in Luke 16, the very interesting parable of the shrewd manager, a parable that many find odd because the shrewd manager acted dishonestly, but he was thinking ahead and thinking for himself, and Jesus uses that where his own master commends him, even though he was stealing money from his master, because he acted shrewdly. And Jesus says, yeah, the people of the world, they know how to act shrewdly better than the people of God. And they know how to use money better for their purposes. So learn from it and let's use material things to store up eternal treasure or to make eternal friends. Let's use material things to do that. How do we do that? Obviously through preaching the gospel, obviously through winning people to the Lord and thereby storing up the ultimate treasure in heaven, human beings who've come to know the Lord through our witness. But he goes on and then gives some stewardship principles. So as we come to the end of the year, and many are thinking about change, many are thinking about how to live differently in the new year, doing serious reflection on the old, let me suggest some things to you based on what Jesus says. One principle, faithful in little, faithful in much. Faithful in little, faithful in much. Many of us think, well, you know, I just never have enough money. And I really can't prove my stewardship. I can't be as generous as I want to be. And look, it's just, you know, I got $5. I blow $5. What does it matter? It's nothing. But then we never get more money. We never have more entrusted to us. If we're not faithful with little, God won't entrust much to us. One time years ago, when I was just starting on radio, and we were on a number of networks, but only a fraction of those were on today. And God willing, in years to come, we'll look back at this as only being on a fraction of the networks that God opens up to us. But this particular day, I was just feeling frustrated by it. And we were just in one region of the country, which meant demographically the callers were mainly from that region. We were not as well known on internet yet, so people weren't just listening from all over America, even when we're not on the radio in their areas. So the calls were more limited to certain parts of the country and limited in number. And I said to the Lord, if you'll give me 1 million listeners a day, I'd love to see even more than that. That'd be wonderful. If you'll give me 1 million listeners a day, I will make this show the absolute best it could ever be. And I knew I didn't need the voice of God to speak to me, but I felt he did speak to me immediately. But I knew the answer. You make this show the best it could possibly be, and I'll give you the 1 million listeners. Yep. Faithful with little, faithful with much. You want to show the Lord your faithfulness and your loyalty, your call to preach to millions of people? Well, be faithful in that Sunday school class you've been given with three-year-olds. Hey, I taught little children in Sunday school before I taught adults. Why? Was I gifted with children? No, not particularly. And that was before I was a married or a father. So why was I teaching little children? Well, I was available. I knew the scriptures. I wanted to serve. And whatever the pastor asked me to do, I joyfully did. And he may have wanted to test me, but he's probably just breaking me in and giving me more opportunities. So, well, I'll be faithful when I get to the adults. Well, you'll get to the adults when you're faithful with children. Faithful with little, faithful with much. What's another principle that Jesus gives? Faithful with material wealth, then you'll be faithful with spiritual wealth. Be a good steward of your money. You want God to entrust his gifts and anointing to you. You want God to entrust a bigger audience to you. You want God to entrust more and more spiritual things to you. He says if you can't be faithful with the material wealth, how are you going to be faithful with the spiritual wealth? And then thirdly, if you can't be faithful with something that belongs to someone else, you won't be faithful with your own. Somebody lends you something. You borrow someone's car. You get to use somebody's camera. Someone lends you something that's important to them because they trust you. If you can't be trusted to take care of what does not belong to you, well, you won't be trusted to take care of something of your own. Here's where we sow seeds for tomorrow. Here's where we grow. Here's where we get stronger for today and for the future. I'm going to come back with another New Year's principle in a moment. But remember, faithful in little, faithful in much. Faithful with material wealth, faithful with spiritual wealth. Faithful in that which belongs to someone else, faithful with that which belongs to you.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to our last broadcast, our last few minutes of the last broadcast of 2015. Very excited about 2016. This is Michael Brown of this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. The first hour in particular, we focused on Jewish-related things, some in the second hour, but we've been doing a lot of year-end talk as well. This note was sent to me earlier. I was unaware of this. I don't think I ever really asked the question, where do we get the tradition of the New Year's Eve ball dropping? Well, it turns out, according to a report on AJC.com, that it turns out a ball drop is a really outdated way to tell time. Time balls were created in the early 1800s to help sailors keep track of the precise time of the day. Soon, people all over the world started using time balls to set their clocks, including people in New York City, the home of the famous New Year's Eve ball drop. So I guess the ball would just drop a certain amount, each, and then you just know what time it was based on that. Well, tradition of the New Year's Eve ball drop, according to the story, goes back to 1907. The first New Year's Eve ball was lowered on a flagpole on top of the building where the New York Times was headquartered. The bowl was 700 pounds, made of iron and wood, and was covered with 100 light bulbs. But according to the New Yorker, the ball drop was a backup plan. Originally, the owner of the Times wanted to set off a giant fireworks display, but instead, the city wouldn't issue him a permit. So it's interesting. Never really wondered about it, but there you have it. According to Thomas Sowell, one of the most respected conservative thinkers in America, according to Dr. Sowell, 2015 was the year of the big lie. That's what he says. The year of the big lie. He said it was the year when we essentially let the world know that we were giving up any effort to try to stop Iran, the world's leading sponsor of international terrorism, from getting a nuclear bomb. He says it will not matter if we have more nuclear bombs than they have, if they're willing to die and we are not. But he says more than anything else, 2015 has been the year of the big lie. There have been lies in other years, and some of them pretty big, but even so, 2015 has set new highs or new lows. Hey, let it be. Let it absolutely be that 2016 is the year of exposing lies, that 2016 is the year of promoting truth. This is the year, Sowell says, when we learn from Hillary Clinton's own emails, after 3 long years of stalling, stonewalling, and evasions, that Secretary of State Clinton lied, and so did President Barack Obama and others under him when they all told us in 2012 that the terrorist attack in Benghazi that killed the American ambassador and 3 other Americans was not a terrorist attack, but a protest demonstration that got out of hand. What difference at this point does it make? As Mrs. Clinton later melodramatically cried out at a congressional committee hearing investigating that episode. Of course, Sowell says, first of all, it made enough of a difference for some of the highest officials of the American government to concoct a false story that they knew all the time was false, knew at the time was false. It mattered enough that if the truth had come out on the eve of a presidential election, it could have destroyed Barack Obama's happy tale of how he had dealt a crippling blow to terrorists by killing Osama bin Laden with an assist from the Navy SEALs. Had Obama's lies about his triumph over terrorism been exposed on the eve of the election, that could have ended his stay in the White House, and that could have spared us and the world, many of Obama's disasters in the Middle East and elsewhere around the world. That is why it matters and will continue to matter in the future. Sowell says lies are a wall between us and reality, and being walled off from reality is the biggest deal of all. Reality does not disappear because we don't see it. It just hits us like a ton of bricks when we least expect it. Now, here is a sobering truth as we come to the last few minutes of our last broadcast of 2015. You can deceive yourself as easily as you can deceive someone else. Let me repeat that. You can deceive yourself as easily as you can deceive someone else. When I say you, I mean me, any of us. We must guard against self-deception by asking ourselves honest questions and refusing to accept excuses. Years back, I was just starting to work out with a trainer that would come into our office, and a few of us would work out together with him in a little workout room that was in our building. And I was explaining why it was really hard to concentrate on eating in a super healthy way because of all the traveling I did and my busy lifestyle and on and on. I went through all the reasons, and the trainer just listened, smiled, didn't say much. And of course, you know, I had great reasons. And a few weeks after that, younger guy was working out with us and was just explaining why, with the busy lifestyle he and his wife have, ministry responsibilities, that it's just really hard to eat really healthily. And as I listened to him, I thought, those are the weakest excuses I ever heard in my life. Those are the wimpiest, weak excuses I've ever had. Well, they were the same as my excuses. But when I heard them from someone else, my attitude changed. Be honest with yourself. Be ruthless with yourself. Don't deceive yourself. And here's a great principle for today and tomorrow. Well, I mean today and tomorrow. I mean the present and the future. From Proverbs chapter 16, verse 3. Proverbs 16, verse 3. I'll quote it to you from Hebrew and translate it. Gol el Adonai Masecha is literally roll on the Lord your works. What's that mean? Whatever you're doing today, your works, your activities, cast them all on the Lord. Cast everything on Him. Sometimes if I have a crazy busy schedule ahead of me that's going to have a lot of difficulties, will we be able to make the right connection for the radio broadcast from here, or are we going to have to do it somewhere else? Will I make this tight connection between flights here, or is that going to create a problem? Will I have the stamina to get through this day and night schedule and with travel and time changes and things like that? And how am I going to get my writing deadlines done in the midst of this? And I'll just sometimes get on my knees and go through my whole schedule. Lord, I commit to you my drive to the office today. I commit to you the show today. I commit to you the drive to the airport. I commit to you the time in the flight. I commit to you the flights. I commit to you the connections. I just go through everything. So whatever you're doing presently, whatever today's activities are, roll today, roll ma'asecha, your works, your deeds on the Lord, all right? V'yikonu machshavotecha, and your plans will be established. In other words, tomorrow will fall into place on its own. Why? Because tomorrow you do the same thing. Tomorrow you get up and you walk in obedience to God. Tomorrow you do what you know how to do. And so tomorrow becomes today, and then the next day will fall into place. It's like this. If you got 10 directions to go to someone, to a location, you need to drive 10 miles on I-20, then you need to turn right, exit on this street, you need to go 2 miles. Well, you just, each time you follow those directions. If you follow the directions ahead of you, you will reach your destination. So do what God's given you to do. Do what God's given you today. Do what God is giving you to do today. Don't worry about tomorrow. Do the will of God today, and tomorrow will fall into place as you do. May you have a blessed and wonderful new year. If we've been a blessing to you, why not make a year-end tax-deductible gift by going to AskDrBrown.org, clicking donate. What a great way to end the year. My bottom line today, you want to see blessing come tomorrow. Do the will of God today.